At the present time, there are estimated to be perhaps as many as 1.7 billion people in the world who call themselves Christian, using the word Christian in its demographic sense, Catholics, Protestants included, and about 1.3 heading toward 1.4 billion people who are adherents of Islam. And it used to be that Muslims were out there in the Middle East and in the other parts of Southern Asia, and they were staying there. Islam was sort of static, stationary. But that has changed. And now there are millions and millions and millions of Muslims who are immigrating out of Muslim nations into Western Europe, into Canada, the USA, and Australia and New Zealand. A massive wave of immigration is happening, has been happening now for several decades. And Western nations welcomed the Muslim immigrants with open arms on the assumption that they would be like other immigrants from other nations, other cultures that over time assimilated to Western culture and would acknowledge the legal system of the nation they came to be a set of laws they could live by. But it's turning out, and more professors of demographics are recognizing that only a relatively small percentage of Muslims and their children coming into Western nations have assimilated to Western culture. A vast, very large majority are purposefully refusing to assimilate. Yes, they will learn English, they will learn French, they will learn German, they will learn the language, but they are rejecting the French, German, Australian, Canadian, American culture and are holding to quite radical views based on the Quran, based on the Islamic religion, the writings in the Hadith. And it's also turning out that millions of them believe that Islam is bringing a set of laws, a new legal system called Sharia law. Please say Sharia law. S-H-A-R-I-A, pronounced Sharia. And they believe that Sharia law is far superior to the legal system of every Western nation and ultimately must replace the constitution of every Western nation. So this means that Muslim demographics are a cause for grave concern to all of Western civilization. And gradually, nations are waking up and realizing we were naive in opening the gates for so many immigrants to come in who are purposefully designing to change our societies. And there are some things that should be changed in our societies. No society is perfect, and every society can be improved. But the kind of things that they regard as an improvement are things that Western people would regard as deepening into a disaster. Sharia law is extremely different from all Western legal systems, which are generally based upon the Judeo-Christian legal system in Old Testament law, the Ten Commandments especially. So that's a cause for grave concern, and that cause for grave concern is amplified awesomely by the fact that while they are immigrating and having lots and lots and lots of children, what are Western families increasingly doing? Having fewer and fewer and fewer children. Demographers are beginning to talk about the birth dearth. Please say that out loud. Birth dearth. Please add it to your vocabulary. Dearth, spelled D-E-A-R-T-H. I'm amazed how many people don't know that word in America. But I learned it in my school books in Canada. You all know about dearth, don't you? A scarcity, a lack of. You might say there's a dearth of wisdom in this committee. But there's a dearth of babies in all of Western civilization, including Japan. Japanese couples are having fewer and fewer babies. And as a result, the Japanese Department of Education in the last 10 years has closed 1,000 Japanese public schools. They just don't have Japanese children to put in them. Increasingly, Japanese school teachers are out of work. And all through Western Europe, the population of the French, the Germans is diminishing. The percentage of population who are Muslim is increasing dramatically. Let me explain that demographers emphasize that for the population of a nation to remain constant, zero growth but also zero loss, the average woman in the whole population has to have 2.11 babies. 2.11. That's just break even. All right, the average birth rate in Spain is 1.3. But it's even worse than that, because the 1.3 includes close to 1 million Muslim women in Spain who are having 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 children each on purpose. The mullahs are urging them, have babies. Don't stop. Don't be like the Europeans. We want to have lots of Muslim babies because all the Muslim children born in this Western nation have the right to vote. And we're going to tell them how they're going to vote when it comes to some future election. So the goal is a takeover. So if you subtract the Muslim immigrant childbearing component out of the 1.3 in Spain, that leaves the average non-immigrant Spanish woman having 0.99 babies, something, it might be 1.01. So it's even worse than a 1.3 would suggest. The same figures apply to France. 1.5 birth rate, but more, far more Muslim women in France than there are in Spain, because much of North Africa is French-speaking, so it's Muslims more readily go to France maybe than to Spain. So Western Europe, like Japan, is going into negative population growth, which means there are fewer and fewer babies growing up and becoming adults and getting jobs and making payments into Social Security. So what does that mean long term? Social Security is going to run dry. So what do they have to do? Invite millions of immigrants to come in, hoping they'll get jobs and have deductions from their paychecks to keep Social Security afloat. But many of those immigrants coming in from North Africa and other Muslim countries purposefully do not get jobs. They go on the dole. They're welcome, they're here, and it's a big hullabaloo if you have to deport them. So they just live on Western European charity, which makes the financial situation even worse. And it's happening in England. So the Muslims tried to take over all of Christian Europe back in the 700s by military force. They had already conquered Spain and Portugal. They invaded France. And they were advancing northward. They got as far as a city called Tours, T-O-U-R-S. And if they'd taken all of France, they would have invaded Germany. They would have crossed the English Channel, attacked England. And it seemed they were unstoppable. But Charles Martel, a Frankish general with an army, stopped their advance at the Battle of Tours. They were defeated and eventually driven out of France. But they still kept control of Spain and Portugal until 1492, the year Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Finally, then they were driven out of France and Portugal, but they still kept control of all of what had been mainly Christian North Africa, where Augustine lived. And there were churches and seminaries across there, and they remained engulfed by Islam. So we live in a day of unprecedented demographic change. And Gaddafi, the head of the Muslim nation Libya, has stated, you can hear him saying it on television, he said, Islam is going to take over all of Europe, and we're not going to need bombs and guns and terrorist attacks to do it. He said 50 million Muslims are living in Europe, and now it's 52 million. He said they're going to take over. All of Europe will be Islamic within a few years, and we're not going to have to fire any bullets, drop any bombs to do it. So what Muslims could not do back in the 700s by military invasion, they are now accomplishing just by procreation. And what do you suppose it is that is causing millions and millions, hundreds of millions of married couples in Western nations, including Japan, which you normally wouldn't think of as a Western nation, but in terms of its technology, it is. What is discouraging people from having babies the way they used to? My mother was number 9 of 13. And I was one of 7 pregnancies, 3 of which didn't succeed, so I'm the oldest of 4 children, but there were 3 other pregnancies my mother had. My first wife and I had 5 pregnancies, 1 ended in miscarriage, but we raised 4 children, we were planning on raising 5. But ever so many people are saying, oh, that's not cool. In fact, we stayed in a home in Oxford in the South Island just a few days ago, and Chris Donaldson, the head of YWAM at that base, and his wife Suzanne said, they had a young couple come as students to the YWAM base there a few years ago from Switzerland. And they proudly announced, we are willing not to have babies because we don't want to overpopulate the world, and it would be unfair to have too many children that would deny other people their resources. And Chris and Suzanne took quite a while to persuade them, you've been misled by your liberal college professors back in Switzerland, that is not a problem. And what is the first command in the Bible? Be fruitful and multiply. Don't subtract, don't divide, multiply. And how many pastors are preaching that command nowadays? None that I know of. It's like everybody assumes there's a natural human instinct to want to have children, want to get married and have a family. And I'm sure there is. But it's proving, history is proving, that that natural human instinct is quite easily overwhelmed by cultural pressures, cultural influences. So we've got 4 main things that are contributing to demographic suicide in all of Western civilization. And one is high abortion rates. I'm sure if you could go back in time and talk to the judges who made abortion legal in the United States of America in the Roe versus Wade case, or the judges in other nations who made abortion legal, if you would say, aren't you afraid that this law that you've passed will contribute ultimately to the self-genocide, the extinction of the human race? I think every one of those justices would have said, no, that won't happen, because people just naturally want to have babies. Abortion rates won't get astronomically high. It will not be a threat to the existence of the human race. But if those justices are still alive now, I wonder if they're rethinking. Or are they just living in their gate-guarded communities, watching television and ignoring what's happening? Who knows? They may all be dead. But it is grim. 50 million babies have been aborted in the United States of America since 1973. And now we're wondering why we have an economic recession. Well, guess what one reason is? Those 50 million babies would all be purchasing adults by now. And they would have all had children by now that would also be purchasing adults. So the whole economy is counting on increased population, an increasing number of purchasers of whatever. But the justice system and the educational system is teaching and influencing counter to population growth, contrary to it. So those millions and millions of people are not there to buy houses. They're not there buying refrigerators and cars. We've undercut the whole economy ourselves by our own legal system and our silly, reckless education system that is so liberal it can't think straight. And it goes around the world. People have got to start thinking differently. Unless the Lord comes quickly, the consequences are dire indeed. So, should we learn something more about Islam than we already know? Are you eager to learn? Good, because I'm eager to teach. So, I want to talk about the Quran. And I'm going to ask the question, are we to believe Muslims who declare that the Quran is a profound piece of literature, inspired by Almighty God, the most awesome thing that has ever been printed on the face of this world, or not? Muslims do make lofty claims for the Quran. For example, Muslims are being taught that the Quran existed in heaven from eternity. Before the universe was created, the Quran was there. Before man, before there was any finite being to read the Quran, it was already written in Arabic in heaven. Paralleling John chapter 1, verse 14 in the Gospel of John, where we read that Jesus is the Word made flesh, the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, Muslims are saying the Quran is the Word made book, which is virtually a deification of a book. Though Muhammad, in four verses in the Quran, admits that he was illiterate, he calls himself an unlettered prophet, four times. Muslims claim that divine inspiration compensated for his personal illiteracy. And the Quran is awesome, it is breathtaking, it is so inspiring, despite the fact that its human author was an illiterate man. The opening verse of chapter 2 in the Quran, which is the longest chapter in the Quran, forbids everyone who reads it to doubt the claims that the Quran makes for itself. The opening verse of chapter 2 is, I quote, "This is a revelation from God not to be doubted." So there's no come let us reason together in the Quran. Bring your critical faculties to examine the Quran, and the Quran will persuade you, no matter how skeptical you are, that it is profound. No, you're not invited to bring any criticism to it, to examine it at all. You're just supposed to accept it, that it's from God and has to be taken as such. So Muslims never jot notes in a copy of the Quran, never underline one verse in it. It is the first thing a devout Muslim family brings into a new home, and it must occupy the highest shelf in the house. Yet even casual readers find numerous stylistic flaws in the Quran. For example, the Quran is astonishingly repetitious. Muhammad tells the Old Testament's Exodus story, Israel coming out of Egypt, heading for the Promised Land. He knew something about that story, listening to Jews talk about it. And it must have been one of his favorite pulpit pieces because he tells the Exodus story 27 times in the first 89 chapters of the Quran. Same story, 27 times in 89 chapters. That's the same story once in every 3.3 chapters. So it makes you wonder if after angels were created, they were the only finite beings to read the Quran. What are we to think of the IQ of angels if they had to have the same story repeated once every 3.3 chapters for 89 chapters? Seems a strange evidence for inspiration from an omniscient being. Not only that, Muhammad tells the story of Noah and the flood 28 times in the first 71 chapters. Divide 28 and 71, you got the same story once in every 2.5 chapters. And it goes on and on and on. He tells the story of Abraham 24 times in the first 87 chapters. And there are dozens of other stories that Muhammad tells at least a dozen times in the Quran. So I did a check and found out if all the stories, and we're talking about stories, not proverbs that might be repeated, stories, if all the stories, the biographical accounts that are repeated in the Quran, were each told just once, that alone would reduce the length of the Quran by 45%. So 45% of the Quran is telling you stories that are already in the other 55%. And what is the effect on the human brain? You and I are reading the Quran, and you're constantly reading what you've already read, and stories are not the only thing that are repeated enormously. The repetition gets to you, your brain starts complaining, what have I done to you that you're punishing me with this? And as a result, everyone who starts reading the Quran starts reading, but you keep going, boredom sets in, and reading gives way to browsing, and browsing eventually gives way to skimming. And all kinds of people who say they've read the Quran, and when I start listening to them talk about it, or I ask them questions about it, I quickly find out they think they've read it, but they've actually just skimmed it. And that includes some scholars who have written books about Islam. They have overlooked things that are in the Quran because they're scholars, why would they overlook something? Well, they're susceptible to boredom too. And it was happening to me. I was reading it and I found, my mind is drifting, I'm just starting to skim. What if I miss something that's important? So I prayed and said, Lord, this is so absolutely, utterly boring, but I've got to stay focused if I'm going to write a well-researched book about it. How can I stay focused in spite of the boredom? And God is so faithful. It's like an answer suddenly was right inside my head. The answer was, you notice the repetitions? I said, yes. That's it then. Dedicate yourself to count the repetitions. Just count the repetitions. That'll keep you focused to turn another page, another page, another page, just to see how many more repetitions of this, that, and the other thing you can find. And in the process, you will find things you would otherwise overlook. And it worked. I endured the boredom, so you won't have to, unless you want to. It is boring. Okay, that's not all. If you would say to a Muslim, you know, I notice the Quran is extremely repetitious, and say it politely, the Muslim may react by saying, well, I've heard the repetitions in your Bible too. Aren't there some stories told in more than one of the Gospels? And you will say, yes, but that's four different writers giving mutually confirming accounts of what happened from four different sources. That's not the same as one source repeating, just to compensate for his lack of wider intellectual horizons. Same thing, any stories that are repeated in the Samuel books, the King books, or the Chronicle books in the Old Testament, three different authors giving mutually confirming accounts of what happened, that's not the same as one author, just repeating himself astonishingly. All right, that's not all that's repeated. When I was reading chapter 2, in the Quran, by the way, the chapters of the Quran, with the exception of chapter 1 and a few others, it starts with the longest chapter up front, that's chapter 2, and then they generally diminish each successive chapter a few verses shorter till you get to chapter 114, which is only about 8 verses. So that's a rather strange way for determining the order of chapters, isn't it? Just count the number of verses, and that decides where a chapter goes. And it's not chronological at all. It's not like the chapters of Matthew where the same story continues and you're following a consistent chronological flow of events. It's just a mishmash of chapters. How are we going to arrange them? Okay, let's put them like this. Let's put the longest one first and all the others are successively shorter. But in chapter 2, I noticed about once in every 8 verses, Muhammad is threatening readers of the Quran with hellfire. Unless they're going to burn in hell, he says again and again, you're going to be inmates of the flame. You're going to be forced to drink boiling water. Then he gets, you know, that isn't enough. You're going to be forced to drink molten metal. And 4 times in the Quran, he describes people in hell. Allah uses the flame to singe away the entire surface area of their skin. And then he renews their skin to be singed away in the flame again and again and again, presumably forever. So I said, one out of eight verses all through chapter 2, he's emphasizing hell. Wow. Can hardly wait to get into chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, all the other chapters, to see which other strings he has to pluck on his harp. But guess what? Chapter 3, 4, 5, 6, same thing. Same thing. And I thought, you know, and here's how you can check this. You can go on a search engine like google.com or whatever, and just type in the word Quran, hit enter, and you'll have maybe a dozen websites that enable you to get the entire text of the Quran right on your computer screen. Choose one that allows you to do a word search. And just type in the name Moses, hit enter, and you'll see the word, the name Moses in bold letters in every chapter where the Exodus story is told. And you can go through and count, see how much that same story is repeated. Just type in the name Abraham, hit enter, you'll see the same thing. Well, just type in the word hell, hit enter, and you will get a majority of 783 verses that threaten readers of the Quran with hellfire if they worship idols, if they refuse to acknowledge Muhammad as a prophet, if they doubt the Quran, if they do not submit to Islamic rule. Hell, 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 hell. Divide 783 into 6,200, which is the total number of verses in the 114 chapters. One out of every eight verses consistently is threatening you with hellfire. So that's another thing that's repeated enormously. I did a check through the New Testament to find out how many verses in the New Testament warn us of God's judgment. And it's one verse out of 120, according to my survey. One verse out of 120. Verses like Hebrews 9:27, for example, it is, "For man wants to die, and after death, the judgment." And is it valid to warn people that God is the judge and judgment will be convened? Everything that is done in secret will be made open. Anything that is not covered by the blood of Christ will be dealt with at the judgment seat of Christ. And other things dealt with at the great white throne. Mankind needs to be warned. God is the judge and he means business. Sin is a serious matter. But Muhammad saw that this valid doctrine of the New Testament was something he could exploit for other reasons, which would be to thoroughly terrify his followers into total submission to him, lest they end up in that hell, and to use the threat of hellfire to cow enemies into stopping their criticism of him. So it's exploited. And the reason I mention this, because when we're dealing with Muslims, if they have read the Quran, which is relatively rare for Muslims, then you know that they are afraid of hellfire. It is so strongly emphasized that hell is there and it's a doom, and God is very eager to cast as many people in there as he possibly can, especially women. Why did I say that? What I'm going to tell you next is not from the Quran, but from the Hadith. Say Hadith. H-A-D-I-T-H, in Arabic, in Farsi, the language of Iran, which is predominantly Shia Muslim, it's H-A-D-I-S, because apparently Farsi doesn't have the T-H sound. All right, in the Hadith, Muhammad declared that Allah granted him a vision of hell, and he looked out this ocean of fire and saw millions of people writhing, screaming, suffering in the flames. He looked closely and saw, why, there's more women down there than men. So he asked Allah, why are there more women suffering in hell than men? And Allah's answer, according to Muhammad in the Hadith, was, it's because women are so unappreciative of all the wonderful things their husbands do for them. Why would he say something like that? Obviously, he was just giving that to Muslim men, something they think is inspired by God to use as a club to browbeat Muslim women into total submission, to suffocate their freedom of speech, their ability to think independently. And that's just one of many, many examples. In the Quran, Muhammad authorizes Muslim men to beat their wives if they are really stubborn. You can actually beat them. And he says other things about Muslim women, women who are slaves of Muslim men. Okay, continuing on down, examining the Quran. Along with all these other flaws, the extreme repetition, or something else that is repeated in the Quran is jihad verses. I counted them. At the back of Secrets of the Quran, I have several appendixes, and one is an appendix giving you the references in the Quran for every war verse called a jihad verse. A verse calling Muslims to be prepared, equipped, and ready for holy war against infidels. And it's 109. Divide 109 into 6,200. You find that one out of 55 verses in the Quran was recited by Muhammad, not written by him because he was illiterate, but recited by him to urge his followers to be ready for violence against infidels. And some of the war verses authorized Muslims to behead us. So when you hear of terrorists capturing a hostage and beheading him, you know that they understand they have authorization from the Quran to do that. In chapter 8, along with authorizing beheading infidels like us, there's also a permission is given to torture us by cutting off our fingertips. They are authorized to ambush us, to tax us heavily with a tax called jizya. Please say jizya. That is a special tax that Sharia law authorizes Muslim rulers to impose upon infidels who would be killed if they don't submit to Islamic rule. But if they totally submit, say, yes, yes, okay, we give in, let Sharia law prevail, we'll never say a word against Muhammad, we'll never speak against Islam, we'll never say anything to discredit the Quran, we totally submit, then they can be allowed to live in a Muslim society, but they're called dhimmis, D-H-I-M-M-I, and dhimmis are subject to the jizya tax, which can be any tax rate the Muslim caliph or sultan decides he wants to impose. Muslims pay a 2.5%. Other people can be charged whatever percent. And Sharia law authorizes Muslims tax collectors, and this was done for centuries in the Muslim world, wherever there were Jews and Christians, to go out and demand the percentage of tax required by Sharia law. And if a Jew or a Christian could not pay the tax, the Muslim tax collector was authorized to say, how many children do you have? This many, all right? Since you cannot pay your tax, we're going to take one son and one daughter from you. That'll be the payment for your tax. Kidnapping Jewish and Christian children from their families is authorized by Sharia law. And I was watching on a documentary on television, a documentary about Islam, and a Muslim woman who is a professor in a university somewhere in the Western world was talking about this practice of kidnapping Christian and Jewish children. And the question was, what did the Muslims do with the children? Well, the Christian and Jewish girls would become sex slaves for a Muslim nobleman in his harem, where, of course, polygamy is fully authorized in the Quran. And the young Christian boys, especially the Christian boys, would be trained as Muslim soldiers. They'd all be force converted to Islam, little children, they wouldn't have much resistance. But Christian boys were especially selected to be trained as what were called janissaries. What did janissaries do? They were the personal guardians of the Sultan in his palace. Now, why did they want to have boys stolen from Christian families to be special bodyguards trained in military arts to protect the Muslim ruler? She said it was because Muslims found they couldn't trust Muslim bodyguards because they would have connections with somebody else somewhere who would bribe them or pay them, kill the Sultan because he imposed a tax on us or he invaded us or he wouldn't do something for us, wouldn't build a highway or a bridge or whatever. So they found they just couldn't trust Muslim bodyguards, but Christian children having something of the Christian ethic were more trustworthy. So they made them Janissaries, and they would, at the cost of their lives, they were just indoctrinated to the point they got to protect the Sultan or the Caliph, whichever he was called. So these war verses are all through. And that's another thing that's repeated. Something else that's a problem for readers of the Quran is Muhammad. Apparently no one ever told Muhammad, you should never use a pronoun like they, them, it, she, he, her, unless somewhere close to the pronoun you provide the noun that pronoun represents. Didn't bother him that he was using all kinds of pronouns and doesn't supply the nouns. So you're constantly reading, and he's talking about someone by way of a pronoun, and you're asking, who was that? Who's he talking about? You don't know. You're constantly reading back a few verses to see if you missed something, or reading on ahead a few verses to see if something, the explanation comes later. It isn't there. For example, in chapter 8, verse 18, Muhammad says, if you were expecting a judgment, now is a judgment come down for you. But if you desist, it would be so much better for you. So you're asking, who did he say that to? Who was that counsel for? You don't know. And what was the judgment that came to them? The one they were seeking, or a different judgment? You don't know. What were they supposed to desist from? Seeking a judgment or something else? You don't know. All kinds of questions are left unanswered. What effect does that have on your brain? Your brain gets weary. This is not logical. This does not make sense. This does not show any sign of being inspired by God. Plus, there are a lot of scientific mistakes. Muhammad defined shooting stars, meteorites, as demons being cast out of heaven. Well, all sorts of things. Not only that, but Muhammad abused classical Arabic both grammatically and lexically. He used the wrong words. He used the wrong rules of grammar in Arabic. How do we know that? Years ago, archaeologists, I should say, in Yemen, the southern end of the Arabian Peninsula, found the ruins of a city that had been abandoned about 1,000 years earlier, and there was a mosque in that abandoned city. So they thought, you know, whenever a copy of the Quran, got tattered and too old to use anymore, they would not throw it in a garbage can. They would not throw it in the fire. A copy of the Quran that was too old to be used, the pages were starting to come apart, they would bury it with honors in a special little hollow place in the wall of the mosque. Like it was a person. It had to be, you know, the remains of it had to be buried. So they said, if we check the walls of this old abandoned mosque, we may find a really ancient copy of the Quran. And they did. They found it. This was the oldest copy of the Quran, more than 1,000 years old. And they said, we need a learned scholar to study this, analyze it, and write academic papers about it. Who did they hire? They did not hire a Muslim scholar. They hired a German professor of classical Arabic named Gerd Puin, P-U-I-N, however that's pronounced in German. He got the job. He read it. So the fact that a Muslim nation would hire him, a German, to do that study is an indication they believe in his scholarliness, they believe in his expertise. I have quotes in Secrets of the Quran from him, in which he says, when you're reading the Quran in Arabic, the original language, which, you know, if you mention to a Muslim about the Quran is boring, it's repetitious, or it uses a lot of pronouns and doesn't give us the nouns and I get confused, a Muslim will say, it's because you're reading it in an inferior language like English or French or German. If you were reading it in Arabic, the repetition wouldn't be boring, the war verses wouldn't be frightening. You would be so impressed, you would be awestruck if you could only read it in Arabic, but unfortunately you can't read it in Arabic. Well, Gerd R. Puin can read it in Arabic, and he says 20% of the text of the Quran in Arabic is bad grammar or the wrong words are used. It is not good Arabic at all. And it's like a friend of mine was teaching a Wednesday evening Bible study, in a home group, and he must have had a hard day, because we all suddenly heard him say, there are devious ways we can serve God. What did he mean to say? There are diverse ways we can serve God. But somehow devious got in there instead of diverse. And he didn't even realize his mistake, and we just kind of smiled at each other and let him continue teaching because we knew what he meant to say. But it's there again and again, Muhammad just uses the wrong Arabic word. He didn't know he was using the wrong Arabic word. And he abuses Arab grammar in the Quran. So the Quran is not any better in Arabic than it is in any other translation. In fact, Gerard Pouin goes on to say that he believes the reason Arabic-speaking custodians of the Quran in Saudi Arabia refused for centuries to give their consent for the Quran to be translated even into other languages of the Muslim world, like Farsi, Urdu. They didn't want to translate it. It has to be in Arabic. They didn't want to translate it into French and German. He suggests the reason they wanted it to be kept in Arabic, because if it was translated into other languages and the translators were honest, what was gibberish in Arabic should also be gibberish in Urdu if they're honest translators, right? And so they thought, that will let the cat out of the bag. Everybody will see this is an awful misrepresentation of anything that could be inspired by God. It's a mess. So they wanted to protect the Quran from criticism by just keeping it in Arabic and hoping that Arabic-speaking readers wouldn't let the cat out of the bag. They'd probably say, no, we're obligated to honor it, so we won't let anybody know how it reads to us. In fact, a lot of Muslims don't read the Quran. You ask the average Muslim, have you read the Quran? The most common answer you will get is, no, I haven't read it, but we all know what's in it. They think they know what's in it. They really, just like Jews, who don't read the Torah, they read commentaries on it, they think they know what's in it. They don't know how much they're missing. So, and I think one reason why a lot of Muslims do not read the Quran is because they're reading and they experience boredom too. And then they also read something else that recurs again and again, warnings, Allah knows what you're thinking, Allah knows what's in your heart. So if they're bored and they are constantly reminded, Allah sees what's in my heart, that he sees I'm bored with this holy book, and he may throw me into hell because I was bored when I was supposed to feel inspired. But the more I read, the more bored I get. So if I'm going to be thrown into hell for being bored by the Quran, maybe I better just stop reading it, because I can't be punished for, I can't be bored by what I haven't read. So not reading it is like a psychological defense mechanism for feeling guilty because you're bored by it. Well, that's my theory about why so few of them read it. But there are others who do read it. And no matter what, they're endorsing what it says and accepting what it says as from God. And that is the source of real radicalism. We'll say more about that later. Now, another problem with the Quran is that in it we find whatever Muhammad downloaded from Old Testament scripture into the Quran, whatever he borrowed from New Testament scripture, is virused. It's not, you know, people say, Muhammad borrowed. Well, if you're borrowing something, you may abridge it, you may paraphrase it, but if you change the content drastically, is that, can that be called borrowing? No. That is like plagiarism. That is like virusing someone else's text. And here are some examples of Old Testament content that got really virused in the process of Muhammad downloading it, so to speak, from Old Testament scripture into his fraudulent book. Muhammad, in his recurring tellings of the Exodus story, leaves something out. Now let me ask you, in the Exodus story, what is the most important event without which there would not have been an Exodus? The Passover sacrifice. The Passover sacrifice is the beating heart of the Exodus story. Guess what? The The Passover sacrifice is not mentioned, not even once in 27 tellings of the Exodus story. Is that an Exodus story or a virus simile of it? It's virused up. And that is an example of how vehemently Muhammad, or the spirit that was in him, was opposed to the whole doctrine of the atonement. He must have known that Christians talked about Jesus as their Passover lamb. He denied the Passover. All right, so that's one example of virusing. And here's something else. Four times in his telling of the Exodus story, he quotes Pharaoh in Egypt in the days of Moses, requiring Haman from the book of Esther to build a tower of bricks up to heaven. Four different Old Testament stories mixed into one. That's virusing. In four of the Exodus accounts, he has God showing his anger against the Jews camped at the foot of Mount Sinai by lifting the entire mass of Mount Sinai right up in the sky and holding it above the camp of Israel. And the people looked up and said, if we don't promise to obey all his laws, he's going to drop Mount Sinai on us. So they all began saying, okay, we'll obey all your laws. Please put Mount Sinai back down on the earth. And he did. That's told four times. As if that was part of the Exodus story. Does that sound virused or what? Terribly, terribly changed. And there are other things like that that turned out to be Jewish bedtime fables that he thought were scripture. And there's a theory about how those strange stories got mixed in with semi-scriptural accounts. And it makes sense. I think it's the most logical explanation for some of these really odd things that are in there. The theory says, well, actually, the first part is not theory. We know that when Muhammad in the city of Mecca, his hometown, was beginning to proclaim himself as a prophet, he said, the same God who sent Moses to the Jews and Jesus to the Christians is sending me to you. And so this was his proclamation, with no miracles, just him saying it. So a lot of pagans said, how do we know that's true? We don't. If you want us to believe that you are a prophet sent to us by the same God who commissioned Moses to the Jews and Jesus to the Christians, we need a second opinion on you, sir. Here's what you have to do. There are no Jews resident here in Mecca, no synagogue. Any Jews who were in Mecca were caravanning from the north to the south or from the south to the north, staying in Mecca overnight. Well, actually, no, they stayed by day because they caravaned at night when it was cool and slept in some caravan stop like Mecca during the hot hours of the day. So the Jews in Mecca were asleep, not there exactly ready to talk about theology with someone like Muhammad. But they said, you have to go to Medina. There's a significant community of learned Jews in Medina. Go and preach to them, Mr. Muhammad. And if they affirm that you are indeed a prophet, that their God was sent to people like us, that will carry weight with us. But we need a second opinion, and it has to come from the Jews up there in Medina. So with the passage of time, Muhammad felt an increasing desire to go to Medina, present himself and his message to the Jews, hoping to win an intellectual affirmation from them. Because if the Jews said to the pagans, he's right, he is a prophet, we endorse him, believe him, that would make an incredible difference. It would have a profound effect on large numbers of pagans, and the new Islamic movement would gain force rapidly. So he was planning. Muslims will say he only left Mecca because he was driven out by the persecution. It was more than that. There was some persecution. But he needed to go to Mecca, to Medina rather, to try to win an intellectual affirmation from the Jews, because this would be a second opinion endorsing his own personal claim about his own calling. But he knew he really didn't know the scriptures. There was no synagogue in Mecca. So he had to get some more information about the Jewish scriptures from some other source. So here's where the theory part begins. He found out there was another Jewish community in a different direction from Mecca. He went secretly to that Jewish community and said, I'm a pagan, but I want to learn about Judaism. Please teach me what's in your scriptures. So they did. They thought, that's great. We'd love to teach you. So they taught him various Old Testament stories. But then he came back to Mecca and preached those stories, claiming he got them directly from the angel Gabriel. Because he always claimed, Allah sent the angel Gabriel to recite to me what's in the Quran up in heaven. And that's why I was getting transmitted to mankind here on earth. So he was fraudulently pumping the Jews for information about the Torah and then claiming he got it supernaturally from God via an angel. The theory says the Jews in that community found out what he was doing. They said, so that's it, is it? Wait till he comes again. So went back again for more information that he could use fraudulently. But they were onto him, and they began purposefully giving him Jewish bedtime stories because they knew he wouldn't know the difference. The intention being, when he preached those stories, he would be exposed as a fraud. Everybody said, that is not in the scriptures. You didn't get that from Gabriel. No way. So that's how these strange Jewish bedtime stories and fables got into the Quran. He didn't know the difference. The Jews set him up. And that would be one way, one reason why he began to hate the Jews with a vehement hatred. But you see, he didn't know until he got to Medina that they had set him up that much. Because when he was preaching in Mecca, nobody knew the difference, right? Okay. But finally, he left Mecca, went nearly 300 kilometers north to a city called Medina. And on the way to Medina, Muhammad said to his 70 or so followers, when we get to Medina, we're all going to prostrate ourselves 3 times a day on the ground and pray toward Jerusalem. Why are they going to do that? This was supposed to impress the Jews that he really was a man they could acknowledge as a prophet. It was like a carrot on a stick. So sure enough, they came to Medina and they were prostrating themselves 3 times a day, praying toward Jerusalem with the Jews watching. And then he approached the Jews and they'd already heard about him. They knew he was a man down in Mecca proclaiming himself as a prophet. So they were curious about him. They met with him and he said to the Jewish rabbis, listen to this and then tell me which part of what he said the Jews would not accept. The same God who sent Moses to you and Jesus to the Christians is sending me to the Arabs. Which part of that did he have no idea the Jews would not accept? The fact that he was saying their God sent Jesus to the Christians. He didn't know the Jews did not acknowledge Jesus. That's how naive he was. So he put his foot in his mouth right from the beginning in presenting himself to the Jews, and the indications are that when the Jews heard him say that, some of them said to him, don't talk to us about Jesus, we crucified him. And he didn't know about the crucifixion. So when the Jews said that in front of his followers, he was surprised, and all his followers surprised, so his followers are thinking, what? Wait a minute, Gabriel didn't tell you about that? Hey, come on, what's going on here? So it was a moment of dire embarrassment. And he had to somehow say something that would ease the terrible embarrassment of this sudden statement from the Jews that just shocked him. So what did he say? He said, you thought you crucified him. It was made so to appear to you. In other words, God deceived you. You thought you were crucifying Jesus. It was mistaken identity. It was someone else. Jesus wasn't there to be crucified because Allah took him up into heaven so you couldn't crucify him. That's in chapter 4 in the Quran, the denial of the crucifixion of Jesus. Something he blurted out when he was taken by surprise became doctrine. Just an attempt to save face. So, Not only is the Passover sacrifice not mentioned in the Quran in 27 tellings, but the crucifixion of our Lord is denied. Things are getting virused, aren't they? Sadly. Well, the Jews refused to acknowledge him as a prophet, but I found evidence that at least some of the Jews wanted to show him goodwill. They knew he was in no way to be acknowledged as a prophet. They refused to give their intellectual affirmation. But apparently they recognized he had leadership ability. He was intelligent. He had charisma, whatever, influence, ability to influence people. So they decided to try to ease his disappointment in their refusing to acknowledge him as a prophet by offering him an alternative to being a prophet, which was, they said, here in the city of Medina, we frequently have severe disagreements and we need an impartial person to be an arbitrator of our disagreements. And it's hard to find a citizen of Medina to be an impartial arbitrator because everybody's on everybody's side, somehow. But you're a man from a completely different city. Would you agree to be appointed by us as an official arbitrator of disputes? Just like Solomon arbitrated things as a king, you can be an arbitrator of disputes. And you'll get paid for each arbitration. Well, this was to enable him to have some means of self-support in a city where he otherwise would have to get a job of some kind. So he accepted, and the Jews agreed to appoint him as an arbitrator. They didn't have to do that. They could have just ignored him and hoped he'd just go away. But the fact that they agreed to that, and Muslim apologists make much of that, they call the appointment of Muhammad as an arbitrator of disputes in Medina as what they call the Constitution of Medina. It was not that. That's aggrandizing it to say it was a constitution, but anyway, that's what they call it. You'll hear about that if you read up on what Muslim apologists say in defense of Muhammad. So he was arbitrating disputes, but he bitterly resented the fact that the Jews from that other community where he was getting wrong information purposefully given to him had tricked him, and bitterly resented the fact that the Jews in Medina refused to acknowledge him as a prophet. They said, prophets work miracles. If you really want an endorsement as a prophet, work a miracle, sir. Make an axe head float in the water, whatever. He couldn't work miracles. Four verses in the Quran show Muhammad complaining about people demanding miracles, as if, why should that be necessary? So when he finally became convinced that there was no way the Jews would acknowledge him as a prophet, his whole attitude toward them changed. Bitterness rose up and replaced his original interest in reaching out and getting some kind of understanding with the Jews. And about that time, he decided, if the Jews are that resistant to my claims, Christians will be as well. There were no Christians there. There's no mention of any interaction with Christians at all. Should there have been? Should there have been churches? If centuries before that, even back by the 300s, Christians had gone all the way from Jerusalem to Ireland, couldn't they have gone a few hundred miles south into the Eyre Peninsula and planted churches there? They hadn't. It was a fault of the church in ignoring, changing the teaching agenda, leaving that part of the world without a witness that could easily have been there. And it might have spared the world from Islam. People would have been able, maybe Muhammad would have become an evangelist, who knows? Well, so